Good morning. Welcome to the March 24th meeting of the Fraud Prevention and State Agency Oversight Committee. Glad to have you all here. I note we have a quorum, and I would like to ask Representative Schultz for approval of the minutes.
Madam Chair, I move adoption of the minutes.
Right. Representative Schultz has moved adoption of the March 17th minutes. All those in favor say aye. Oh, any
aye.
Discussion? Okay. No. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Minutes are adopted. All right. This morning we have a very full agenda, members. We are honored to have with us commissioners from the Department of Management and Budget, Public Safety, Human Services, IT, Administration, Education, and Children, Youth, and Families. So we have a lot to get through. So we are going to go through the commissioners' presentations in order listed on the agenda. And I'm asking commissioners to keep it to about, hopefully, 10 minutes, just because we have so many to get through. And then, members, we will ask clarifying questions at the end of each section, so each commissioner can address those immediately, and then we'll move on to member discussion of the whole package as there's time at the end, which I hope there will be. So I know I'm one of the biggest offenders of over-questioning, and so I'm gonna try and keep my questions minimized as well. But this is a very important consideration of how we are going to systemically address fraud in state agencies, and so we want to move through the package as quickly as possible. So with that, we are happy to have Chair Pinto presenting the bill this morning. Chair Pinto, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. The anti-fraud package put together by the administration is in House File 2603. A copy's been distributed to members. It's gotten a little bit complicated because the different pieces are moving separately, the different committees, and so the version in front of members, I think it took the reviser a little bit of time to put together. And so there's both a large packet and then a separate packet that says state government. In any case, I'm honored to be the author of the bill. We'll want to hear from the commissioners regarding the details of it, but I'll just note that it builds on work that we've all done together over a number of years, and in particular, last term, a lot of progress was made. But with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn things to the commissioners. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. So first, I think we'll turn to Commissioner Erin Campbell. Please state your name for the record and begin your presentation. Thank you.
All right. Good morning, Chair Robbins, Lead Pinto, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Campbell, and I'm the Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. I'm here with several of our agency partners today to present the overview of the governor's anti-fraud package. As you all know, the state of Minnesota provides critical services every day for the security, benefit, and protection of all Minnesotans. Minnesota is a state committed to helping people, and we're committed to providing services that improve the lives of Minnesotans. Fraud against these public programs is unacceptable. It's not a victimless crime, and it harms the same people that we're trying to help with these services. As the financial stewards of these public funds, we take fraud and misuse of public funds very seriously and are committed to safeguarding those public funds. As long as there have been programs aimed at helping people, there have been fraudulent actors looking to steal from those who need them most. Fraudsters have gotten more sophisticated, and our job is to stay one step ahead of them. Through executive action, budget, and policy, we are taking a holistic approach to equip state agencies with the resources and tools to better detect fraud, take action, and investigate and hold fraudsters accountable. The proposals we'll be outlining today build on investments made in 2023 to improve the state's capacity to detect and respond to fraud, like expanding the Office of Grants Management at the Department of Administration and broadening debarment authority, establishing an inspector general at the Department of Education, and providing the Department of Human Services more tools to improve controls, oversight, and contract compliance. They also come in the context of significant successful fraud prevention efforts at the Department of Revenue that from 22 to 24 have prevented $263 million in fraudulent refunds, forced compliance with state law that resulted in $1.4 billion in revenue being collected that would have otherwise have gone to those trying to avoid payment, saved the state $1.804 billion, more than $600 million a year by stopping fraud and forcing compliance. The items you'll hear about today fall into three core categories: stronger investigative and enforcement authority, better detection and oversight, increased criminal penalties. I will speak broadly to elements within each of these areas, and then my colleagues and I will provide more detailed information on specific proposals. To provide better detection and oversight, the state would use AI to compare information and detect Medicaid payment discrepancies in real time, strengthen EIDBI Autism Center oversight by requiring licensing, add internal controls and oversight capacity within MMB, and clarify the Department of Education's ability to ensure charter schools' compliance with procurement policies. The governor has issued an executive order to integrate the Department of Commerce Fraud Bureau agents into the Centralized Financial Crimes and Fraud Section at the BCA, dedicated to investigating financial crimes and fraud. The proposal also adds investigatory capacity to the Attorney General's Medicaid Fraud Investigatory Unit, responsible for investigating and prosecuting Medicaid providers who submit false claims for reimbursement. The package also seeks to provide clear and expanded authority to stop payments and sanction bad actors by enabling agencies to withhold payments from potentially fraudulent actors if there's a credible allegation of fraud, prevent bad actors from getting state contracts across multiple agencies, and debar entities from receiving state funds. The governor's anti-fraud package includes proposals to create a new theft of public funds statute to increase criminal penalties by 20% compared to current law, and mirror federal anti-kickback laws in the DHS space and give the Attorney General's authority to pursue criminal charges. Now we'll get into the specific proposals. Each of my agency partners will discuss the proposals for their agency, and I'll quickly cover the one that pertains to MMB. The governor has proposed a range of additional investments here at MMB to meet the public's expectations for our oversight responsibilities related to state finances and the state workforce. Highlighted here on the slide are two relevant parts of the proposal. We're eager to add additional capacity to our internal controls team, especially the opportunity it presents to add more training and assistance with the goal of further building a culture of compliance across the state agencies. The additional staff focused on MMB financial resource policies will allow us to provide better support for our agency partners in their understanding and implementation of these important statewide policies. I'm happy to stand for questions. Otherwise, I will turn it over to Superintendent Evans.
Thank you, Commissioner Campbell. I think if we don't have any specific questions right now, we'll move on to keep going. Thank you, Superintendent Evans. Please state your name for the record.
Excuse me. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the Superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. A component that was referenced by Commissioner Campbell is well underway, and I'll go over that briefly. On February 7th of 2025, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Financial Crimes and Fraud Section combined with the Commerce Fraud Bureau to form one larger Financial Crimes and Fraud Section to address all types of criminal fraud in the state of Minnesota. This ensures a focused approach, utilizing resources efficiently to be able to disrupt and hold offenders accountable for committing criminal fraud across the state of Minnesota. As part of this, and in your packets today, you'll see a language that improves transparency in terms of reporting, efficiencies that are to be gained, and then consistency in our approach to fraud. Excuse me. It also creates, as noted, this new fraud section, and that is underway. It's going well, and we are currently accepting cases in our traditional types of crimes that the teams have investigated, and also fraud involving state government program agencies. Let me go next slide. This new section is focusing on insurance fraud, wage theft, fraud in state government programs, traditional financial crimes, and fraud committed against individual Minnesotans, and then the auto theft program that was historically in a couple of different agencies last at the Commerce Fraud Bureau. I'll just note for the committee, part of the work that we're doing here is really to tackle all these different types of crimes. One of the things that certainly through your work and others have noted is that fraudsters are agnostic in terms of where they wish to commit their frauds, if it's against state government programs, if it's against individual Minnesotans. I referenced in committee last week, you know, $12.5 billion in reported individual fraud was reported to the financial the Federal Trade Commission last year, which is probably a very small amount of fraud because it's a voluntary reporting. I also note, as you see every single day, I was just noting to Jordan before I got in here today, as I'm sure many of you have gotten the FastPass notification on your phones, fraudsters are becoming increasingly sophisticated. I know what it is, and I almost fell for it this weekend, was the story that we were looking at. So this is part of what we're doing to combine all these resources together, not just to address state program fraud, but those other broad arrays to make sure that we have all of the experts in the state of Minnesota working together combating fraud in whatever form it may be. As part of the governor's budget recommendations as well, there's one forensic accountant to help us address the increasingly sophisticated financial schemes that we see. So that an accountant's dedicated to that team, and then two attorneys generals that would be assigned to that team as well. One, to be able to provide our prosecutorial assistance at the request of county attorney's agencies. These cases are often very large, and especially in greater Minnesota where there's smaller offices that would provide assistance in that process. And then secondary, to provide advice to our team and as they approach these, to think of new and innovative ways to approach the investigations with the fraudsters. And then third, to be able to provide feedback to state agencies at the conclusion of those investigations with us, to be able to provide feedback to tighten programs, to be able to figure out ways to improve so that we prevent fraud in the future if it was identified in one of the agencies. Also with this new unit, I do think it's important as we're working through this, this is not an inspector general's office. The way this works is this is that we are doing what we've always done. When criminal fraud is identified or a crime is identified, whatever it may be, it is referred to the BCA and we will conduct the criminal investigation. This unit will work closely with the inspector generals that exist in state agencies and that function, whatever it may be, moving forward in those agencies. And that is critically important to have both components, criminal investigation and the civil regulatory investigation detection that must occur in the state agencies where that subject matter expertise is critically important. The last part of the BCA part of this proposal is a new theft of public funds. Certainly, and we have prosecuted people for theft under the theft statutes that exist currently. Our theft statute has been cobbled together over many years. It's complicated in some ways, and because this has been such a focus, we're proposing a new theft of government funds with the top tiers being a 20% increase in penalties compared to the current theft statute. The idea behind this is that it makes it very simplistic, but if it is a public funded program, that there is a standalone statute that makes it very easy for us to pursue investigations and criminal charges with our prosecutors in that process. And then those increased penalties simply reflect the seriousness of stealing state government program funds, whatever form they might be in. And I'm happy to take questions now, Madam Chair, as well, or I will turn it over to the Department of Human Services.
Thank you, Superintendent Evans. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good to see you, Superintendent Evans. I'm just curious. I know that as Feeding Our Future and all of that was happening, it went up to the feds. How will this change compare to what federal law is and really the structure of all that? Because we have plea bargains, downward departures. We have good time that's in much, much more excess than the federal government. Can you just help us understand how close are we getting to the federal, if this was done federally?
Superintendent Evans.
Madam Chair and Representative Rarick, I'll answer in two parts. The first is a good question. So part of the reporting that needs to occur now, and state agencies are doing that as part of the governor's executive order, is any potential misuse of government funds is getting duly reported. We have a strong relationship with the OLA. They will do their investigation as they always have. They report criminal fraud to us now when they discover it in that process. But we'll have that discussion on the front end if a criminal investigation should be launched or the OLA should take their process in that. We will then do an investigation of that criminal fraud as well. And then the question about the federal government and how that works, we'll still utilize them. Some of these fraud programs are pass-through money or federally funded programs, sometimes mixed with state money, sometimes it's standalone federal money. We work daily with our federal partners, whether it's an inspector general and DHHS and Department of Human and Health and Human Services, a variety of different federal programs work together with them and the FBI. Since this team has formed into one standalone team, I've had discussions with both the FBI and just last week, the Attorney General's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit at the state side, and then also with the United States Attorney's Office as they form and get permanent leaders with the Attorney General's Office, in particular for Minnesota. We'll have those discussions as to what makes sense. More pointedly to your question probably about the fraud itself, I don't know that off the top of my head. The federal penalties are certainly more serious than state law, and that's true really across the board for a variety of types of crimes. And what we do with those cases in other arenas where we're used to doing this and making it every single day is looking at those different areas and communicating with the U.S. Attorney's Office for the state of Minnesota and determining the best course between our federal partners in this. So this isn't designed to replace or mirror federal penalties. This is to increase, to identify that, in particular in those cases where the threshold isn't met. Typically, our federal partners are looking for larger cases before they're willing to take that. So this reflects an increase in penalties for those lower level tier cases that may have not been taken before, but we'll still take both routes depending on what's most appropriate for that case.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I have several questions. So
maybe let's do one or two. We need to move on. Thank you.
I think the BCA is, my understanding, has done an excellent job with, I guess, crimes against persons, right? So that's typically, I guess, that's the best description. And by bringing, you know, this piece in together, which is essentially insurance fraud, 70% of it's insurance fraud that was done over at Commerce into this, what's left? Because my interest is fraud against government programs. That's where my interest is. And it seems that we're adding just one person to, you know, an entity that really hasn't done hardly any fraud against persons. In fact, my also understanding is that that a lot of the things that were referred to the BCA really weren't taken because they didn't meet threshold requirements. So they didn't, you know, things that came out of the OIGs within divisions. But what would change besides having one forensic accountant that's working on all sorts of stuff, what would actually be added here for the public programs?
Superintendent Evans.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, it's a good question. So that traditionally you're used to seeing the BCA for crimes against persons because that's often what gains the most attention. But we've run a financial crime and fraud section for a very long time and worked on that. We command the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force, and we have 16 agents and individuals that are doing that work now. They've been doing fraud work with state government programs and contracts that we have in that process. The Commerce Fraud Bureau, as you correctly stated, had a statutory requirement that required them to do 70% of their time on insurance fraud and then 30% for other types of financial crime. By combining them together, we gain a number of efficiencies. For example, as a standalone agency, they had to address digital evidence. It's everything we do has a digital evidence component. So they had two agents that did that work. At the BCA, we have a full digital multimedia evidence unit that does that work. The agents don't have to do that work. They do their traditional investigations. There's a whole bunch of administrative tasks that are associated with running a law enforcement agency that's becoming increasingly sophisticated as more and more requirements are there. Those will be centralized, so that frees up additional time. There's a number of different things that we look at that when we look at across the board by combining, we're able to gain efficiencies in that process, and we're able to then utilize that time. And I don't think about it as individuals. I think it as hours available to be able to address state program fraud. Also, as I noted, we have contracts with some state agencies to do this, and as we get into this work, if we discover that one particular program or an agency has a large volume that are getting referred, we'll have conversations with that agency about contracting as well so that it doesn't take away from that important work of insurance fraud, wage theft, financial crimes, and then state program fraud. But we have been doing some of that work, and combining together, we will gain capacity in that process by working together in that from there. So they've already been taking cases. I don't know what is being referenced we don't take from inspector generals. I'm not aware of any threshold requirements for us that we haven't taken cases. But as that goes, we'll certainly do that. The requirements in state statute right now, in your packets, we have a framework that's been laid out as to what that unit would be required to do. And that would be any case that's $100,000 or more in loss, this unit would be required to investigate. If it's $100,000 or less, they'd still be reported. But we may triage that to a local agency or determine whether or not in there. So we bake that in so there's some assurances for you that that work is being done and we're confident that the capacity is there.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I really appreciate how you have been talking about this the last couple of months as this has come together. A question I have about some of these frauds that are sort of encompass a lot, and I'm specifically thinking about misclassification fraud, where there may be wage theft. I think under this new statute, the theft of public funds, the theft against the UI Trust Fund or tax withholdings might be included. I'm wondering how you're thinking about frauds like that, that have a couple of different elements that may be both civil and criminal, and how this new consolidated entity that now won't just be BCA, commerce fraud, and maybe the agencies can actually more efficiently help us fight sort of all of the tentacles of frauds like that.
Superintendent Evans.
Madam Chair, Representative Greenman, another great question. So this also doesn't take away any of the civil authorities within the regulatory agencies that exist. So there have been meetings, as you're probably aware, on misclassification crimes and taking a look at that now in a task force that's put together with the Department of Labor and Industry, also with Commerce. Both those agencies retain their civil and regulatory functions in misclassification. This team has people that are assigned to that working group from our BCA Financial Crimes and Fraud section. They're a part of it. I've joined that to better learn about the work that's being done there, and they're troubleshooting and identifying ways to hold people accountable, and it will come out of this section for criminal actions related to misclassification and wage theft, and then also the civil regulatory approaches that those agencies can take. Also, we have operated a Minnesota Human Trafficking Investigators Task Force. That team has been traditionally only worked on sex crimes due to funding limitations, but in the last year, last biennium, you provided us additional resources so that we can do labor trafficking as well. So that team will work together with this team as to when a wage theft misclassification turns into a labor trafficking case, and they will either work together or pass it over to our trafficking team.
Thank you. Thank you, members. I think we'll move on to Commissioner Gandhi. Thank you. Welcome, Commissioner. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Shireen Gandhi, and I'm serving as the temporary commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. For the Department of Human Services components of the governor's anti-fraud package, it's important that we start with accurate data of our program integrity work that necessarily goes on behind the scenes. We don't want to build new approaches on the backs of speculation or conjecture. We need to build them on the backs of facts. A few facts to keep in mind of where we are today. The DHS's Office of Inspector General oversees 390,000 care providers. 142,000 of those are entities. In the last 5 years, DHS has conducted more than 4,000 investigations, stopped payments to more than 600 providers, referred more than 400 cases to law enforcement, and has recovered about $18 million a year on average. For the amount spent on investigations, that's an ROI of $1.89 for every dollar invested. So with that in mind, what are the challenges that we face to doing more, and how does the governor's anti-fraud proposal address these challenges? So I'll take each of these bullets on the slide. First challenge, the number of providers and payments DHS oversees are rapidly outpacing our staff. This proposal adds staff to program integrity operations with a track record of a positive ROI, as I stated, for $1.89 for every dollar invested. Challenge, the bad actors continue to get more sophisticated, so we need to step up our game too. We must continue to improve and evolve our oversight and detection efforts as fraudsters evolve their methods. This proposal leverages private sector expertise by funding a contract to conduct prepayment reviews of selected claims before they are paid. And what this does is give us an earlier intervention so that we, before that we have to use payment withholds. Challenge. It can be difficult to share data across agencies to take action early. Currently, the limits on receiving public funds statute allows DHS to take action when providers have been excluded by other states or federal agencies. That's not timely enough. This proposal expands authority for data sharing to investigative and other relevant data, allowing agencies to act more quickly to protect public funds and not wait until a disqualification has taken place in another agency. Challenge. Bad actors exploit loopholes and shortcomings of the current statutes. For example, DHS may immediately suspend a license if the license holder is criminally charged with theft for fraud against a DHS program. This proposal expands the scope to include not only license holders, but also controlling individuals, and expand the scope to a charge of fraud or theft against any state or federal agency. This proposal also allows for the authority to disqualify people under active investigation for fraud from holding any position of ownership, management, control, or billing for which the background study was conducted. Challenge. The growth in autism diagnosis has been growing across the state, creating an increased demand for services. As a result, the number of EIDBI providers has grown as well. DHS does not currently have the authority to address child maltreatment that occurs in these providers. In the news last spring, there was an egregious child abuse case that DHS did not have the authority to act on and had to wait for local law enforcement to investigate and charge the crime. This proposal establishing provisional licensure allows DHS to provide a faster response protecting children and families. Provisional licensure, which is a step along the path to full licensure, gives DHS more tools to check controlling individuals' quality of care and billing practices. Challenge. DHS discovered that substance use disorder providers had billing practices that resulted in some providers providing two time-based claims that partially overlapped the one-hour unit. This proposal would provide clear statutory authority to stop this practice by aligning statute with guidance for time-based codes from the Minnesota Department of Health rule and the CMS claims manual. And there's one more proposal for DHS that is a partnership with Minute to leverage technology and artificial intelligence to give us tools to use data in new ways. And I'd like to turn it over to Commissioner Tomes to discuss that one.
Thank you. Commissioner Tomes, welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify this morning. For the record, my name is Tarek Tomes, and I am the Commissioner of Minnesota IT Services and the Chief Information Officer for the state of Minnesota. Like my colleagues, Minute is committed to advancing the state's anti-fraud prevention efforts. The request in the governor's budget proposes advancing our fraud detection and prevention efforts by utilizing a proactive, scalable, data-driven approach using modern artificial intelligence and machine learning capabilities. We know bad actors continue to evolve their attack methods, and as technology capabilities evolve, we also need to adapt the ways we combat fraud. This proposal represents a significant advancement of proactive, data-driven fraud prevention at the state. Just as a point of context, globally, people have been defrauded of over $1 trillion over the last couple of years. You know, truly a staggering number. Much of that has come by the form of what is referred to as authorized push payment fraud. Superintendent Evans kind of alluded to that. I seem to get a question every week from someone asking me, you know, is this real? You may have received an Easy Pass invitation to pay for a toll, you know, while driving recently. $1 trillion, 25% increase in consumer fraud in the United States. By advancing the state's data and analysis capabilities through the use of data warehouses, we will increase our ability to analyze data from different systems and to do so proactively. This proposal also seeks to invest in market-leading tools and capabilities to proactively analyze enriched data to detect bad actors and suspicious activity. In the United States, 65% of large companies are increasing investment in fraud detection capabilities over the last year. In order to ensure maximum effectiveness, a both-and approach is required. Artificial intelligence is a powerful tool to fight fraud, but it requires both strategies for maximum effectiveness. The proposal is for a pilot program to use artificial intelligence to flag anomalies for Medicaid providers through the Department of Human Services. This pilot is a critical first step to build this capability across executive branch agencies and programs. With recent advancements in artificial intelligence and data management, now is the time to do more. We have an opportunity to provide new tools and cutting-edge technology to enhance continuing oversight of Minnesota's Medicaid program, safeguard public funds, and establish Minnesota as a leader in data-driven fraud prevention. The artificial intelligence fraud prevention tool market, the providers that provide tools in this space, is expected to grow over 16% in the next year. This new proposal builds upon past investments made by the legislature, including the State Government Finance Committee, to enhance the way state agencies manage identities of users, increase accessing state programs and services, essentially adding capabilities to do identity verification when citizens, residents, visitors sign up for services with the state. The 2023 legislature made significant investments to build a modern identity and access management system that will support improved identity verification capabilities that over time will enable enhanced fraud prevention across state programs. Madam Chair, that concludes my statements, and would welcome or stand for questions.
Thank you. I do have a quick question. So many groups have reached out to me to talk about helping manage fraud in detection using AI tools, and I've met with several of them. And so there's a lot of off-the-shelf products out there, some of whom are used very robustly in other states. Are you planning on, as you look at requests for proposals for this pilot project, are you looking to build it internally, or are you looking at products that are already in use in other places?
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for that question. At Minnesota IT Services, over the last 5 years, 6 years, our approach, our policy as it relates to solutions has been something that we refer to as rent by build. If there's a market-based solution that we can procure in the marketplace and rent it, and those are typically cloud-based services, we look to rent it. If we can't rent it, but there's a vendor-based solution that we can buy, then we look to buy it. And really only as a last resort, you know, do we look to self-develop solutions. As it relates to this particular solution, we absolutely aim to partner with the vendor marketplace to procure something that already exists, either in the financial sector or in the retail sector. You know, many of us from our credit card companies, if there are suspicious credit card transactions, we get a text message notifying us or asking us, is this really you? These types of tools and capabilities exist in the marketplace and are continuing to evolve, as evidenced by that 16% growth in the vendor marketplace. Our intention absolutely would be to not build anything.
And so the money is being housed in DHS, $6 million in the first 2 years of the biennium, and then $5 million each year in the tails. Will you be making these decisions? Will Commissioner Gandhi be making these decisions? Who spends that money?
Madam Chair, committee members, I think it, you know, as it relates to so many of these efforts, it's truly a partnership that requires a holistic and comprehensive approach. Everything from the case management capabilities that lead to things that have been flagged as suspicious and the need to follow up, which, you know, is a heavy business side activity, as well as the crucial, you know, data warehousing and making sure that data is available for these vendor-based solutions. And so we will partner heavily on this. Decisions that need to be made as it relates to implementation.
Thank you. All right, Representative Anderson.
I'll be quick. So are you looking at more, you talked about managing identities, and I understand that, you know, fake names like Feeding Our Future and others. Are you looking at, is that the main focus of this, so that you're actually looking at, do these people exist that are getting services, or are they eligible? In the case of some of the Medicaid, for example, is that the main focus of this, or are you also looking at individual programs or billers, payees, I guess, that are all of a sudden their numbers have jumped through the roof?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. It's really a holistic approach. This particular aspect of it is really focused on the artificial intelligence and the machine learning capabilities to make sure that there are robust vendor market-based capabilities that analyze both good transactions as well as bad transactions to flag anomalies and make sure that those things that are flagged have appropriate follow-up. I think a robust fraud prevention and detection mechanism, though, requires really a holistic approach. And in the last legislative session, there was an investment made related to just the identity verification as people sign up. We want to get as preemptive and as far upstream as possible to proactively make sure that people are signing up are the people that should be signing up and that identities are verified to the full extent, but that also the ability to flag transactions as they're occurring in real time for follow-up and to really put a risk profile next to the types of transactions that, you know, not just permeate the Medicaid system, but really state programs in general as other organizations, both nationally and internationally, are doing.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions, one for Commissioner Gandhi and one for Commissioner Tomes. So Commissioner Gandhi, you had said that you've had $18 million per year recovered, and I'm wondering what is the total of your annual budget, including federal money?
That would change year over year. Right now, this year, our budget is about $25 billion.
Thank you. And I have a question for
Commissioner Rarick. Representative Rarick.
Thank you. And then Commissioner Tomes. And so I'm really having a hard time understanding how you're going to interface with computer programs that were built in the late 80s and early 90s that are still green screen, F key, and they have the wheel of death every single day for people that use them. How do you possibly interface with all of that ancient technology with AI? I don't understand how the two. I mean, why can't we just fix these ancient technologies that we built back in the 80s and 90s? And shouldn't that be the square one? I don't understand how this works.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. I think there's a lot, you know, to unpack in that question. Maybe I'll start on the tail end and work my way forward towards the data side. I think modernization of legacy systems that include, you know, what we refer to in our space as significant tech debt, but really, you know, that more follows, you know, significant debt as it relates to just service, you know, provider capabilities in general, is a extreme priority of ours and has been over the last 5 to 6 years. We've been able to modernize the driver and vehicle system completely, modernization of the system that runs, the main systems that run the Department of Corrections, huge-scale modernizations at DEED. And so modernizing these large systems, you know, is continuing as a part of the governor's current budget proposal is modernization of the child welfare system, one of the elements that really has a huge impact on counties as it relates to this tech debt-laden system that we refer to internally and counties understand under the name of SSIS, which, you know, is hugely problematic. We're incredibly hopeful that as a part of this legislative session, we're able to move forward that child welfare modernization, not for the sake of modernizing technology, but for the sake of serving children better as it relates to these technologies. There is a huge distinction, though, as it relates to older systems, tech, and data. Capability to still get at transactions exists no matter how old the technology is. Our ability from a technology perspective in today's technology marketplace to interface with those systems to analyze transactions is not a barrier. The barrier comes in how those systems serve people and both our employees within the state and how they serve people that are interacting with them. You know, that's where the hugest tech debt area lies, outside of the risk of those systems simply not being functioning or being susceptible to cybercrime. So the technologies and capabilities to interface with these systems are quite robust, and the ability to implement vendor-based artificial intelligence capabilities to interface with the transactions, the flag transactions, is something that's readily available in the marketplace.
Could I just have a quick follow-up comment?
One quick follow-up, then we'll go to Representative Elkins.
Thank you. So SSIS takes, you know, you go to any county and the poor folks using that, it takes 70% of their time because you have green screen F keys and the wheel of death. It takes them forever to do it. So I think that seems to be a high priority, but there's not just SSIS. There's also five other programs that are as equally bad the counties have to use. They came in and did a presentation in another one of my committees. So I don't see this as a huge solution. Also, I would point out that the money recovered out of, so $18 million out of $25 billion annually is 0.072%. That's how much money is recovered. I'm sure that more than that was going out fraudulently. So it's a drop in the bucket, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think one of the points that Commissioner Tomes is making is that no matter how ancient your operational systems or modern there are, you still have to extract the data out of them and into an analytical data warehouse. And that work can be done semi-independently of the front end. You structure the data in the analytical systems so that you can point analysis tools, point AI at them in any case. And that, I think that's the work that is going on right now, is improving the analytical capabilities for the data that you take out of these currently ancient, hopefully sometime in the not too distant future, modern operational systems.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I think we'll move on at the moment to Commissioner of Department Administration, Commissioner Granvall. So members, if you're confused, it's the last slide on your packet because the order of the testifiers on the list is different than the order of the packet slides. So please proceed, Commissioner Granvall.
Good morning, Chair Robbins, Representative Pinto, and committee members. I'm Tamar Granvall. I'm the commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Administration. The governor proposes additional safeguards related to state grants. Specifically, the proposal expands authority to suspend or debar grantees to include potential grantees. This is an effort to prevent entities who have not previously received state funds but have engaged in or been convicted of debarment-worthy causes from becoming recipients of state-issued grants in the future. The causes for debarment include serious issues such as crimes as embezzlement, theft, bribery, or falsification of records, among other serious convictions and violations. The proposal would expand the definition of grantee to include potential grantee, which ensures that admin can exercise its debarment authority for existing grantees as well as potential grantees. The proposal also amends existing obligations on state employees to require a report of violations of grants laws or rules. Current law has mandatory reporting requirements in place for state employees related to all unlawful activity. This change clarifies this required reporting as related to violations specific to grant laws or rules. The governor's proposal also strengthens the authority of state agencies to share data with one another related to suspected or confirmed fraud in public programs. If the access promotes the protection of public resources, promotes the integrity of public programs, or aids in the law enforcement process.
Thank you, Commissioner, Representative Erick.
Thank you. Just really quickly. So you said that state employees now are required to report violations of the grant laws or rules. What happens if they don't?
Commissioner?
The governor's package would make that reporting mandatory. If they don't, there'd be an investigation into that activity. There'd be inquiries. There would be, we would take steps to examine the employee's behavior and what actions are appropriate.
Representative Eric.
And then what happens if a supervisor told them not to report it? What happens to the supervisor? Yeah.
Commissioner.
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick, I imagine the same, I envision the same thing. There would be, we take that behavior very seriously. There'd be an investigation. We would find out what happened, who said what, when, what was understood, what was not understood. You'll remember that current law right now requires employees to report to the OLA when they suspect criminal activity. The governor's package right now requires employees at any level to report to the BCA when they suspect possible criminal behavior. So that behavior we take very seriously. We'd follow up thoroughly and take action appropriately.
Thank you. Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. So are you saying right now give grants to people who have been convicted of embezzling state funds or fraudulent, and there's nothing that's stopping you from doing that across state government, grants management?
Commissioner?
Chair Robbins, Representative Anderson. Right now, current law allows us to cancel a grant if it's not in the public interest. So that's pretty broad authority. Of course, we would not issue a grant to anyone that we know of or have information that's engaged in any kind of questionable activity. So that is not something that that we do in the state grants space.
Commissioner,
Vice Chair. Thank you. Anderson. So your part of this proposal is to give you authority that you currently have for the potential grantees that have been to stop them that have already been convicted of embezzlement, fraud against the state, et cetera. So that's a proposal?
Commissioner.
Chair Robbins, Representative Anderson. Yes, this proposal is to expand the authority that we have right now. We are allowed to cancel a grant if it's in the public interest. So a grant, this expanded authority allows us to debar a grantee, a potential grantee. So a grantee who's not ever received funds, debar them, meaning kick them off the list because they've applied and we have information that they've engaged in these activities. So yes, it's expanding the authority.
And you think that you need that authority. You don't have that authority now to stop these people from getting grants.
Commissioner.
Chair Robbins, Representative Anderson, that is correct. Right now, we do not have the authority to debar potential grantees. So we can debar current grantees. We can cancel a grant if we see that it's not in the public interest. But if we have an entity or a person coming to us for the first time, they're a potential grantee, they haven't received anything, we can say, hey, we're looking, we see that this person or this entity, there's some serious issues there. We are going to debar them, put them on a do not give grants list, essentially. And right now we don't have that authority for potential grantees.
Oh, okay, thank you. I just don't understand because we do competitive grants processes and you have the authority the agencies have the authority to choose. And so this would, to me, be an automatic choice that you wouldn't be giving public funds, public grants to people who have embezzled dollars or committed fraud. But, okay, thank you.
Commissioner.
Chair Robbins, Representative Anderson, we don't, if we have any information now, we do not give grants to entities or persons that we have information that have engaged in any kind of nefarious activity.
Okay.
We are expanding this request for authority to debar grantees. So I think perhaps the difference is debarring a grantee is putting them on a do not give list that applies to everybody. And it's different than canceling and debarring a current grantee.
Okay.
If I could follow up for a moment. So my understanding is there is no D-bar list at the moment. That's one of the things that people have been wanting to produce so that agencies know across the enterprise who's been a bad actor and who is not. So are you saying there currently is a D-bar list out there?
Chair Robbins, my understanding is yes.
So how would we know who's on that list?
The agencies ask each other. That's my understanding. And I want to make sure I get you the correct information. I can follow up with some additional information.
Yes, I'd be very interested in that because my understanding from the OLA and other testifiers is that that's one of the issues we're trying to solve is that there hasn't been the ability to create a D-bar list. And if it already exists, I would very much like to see that. So thank you. All right, next we'll move on to Commissioner Brown. Thank you.
All right, good morning, Chair Robbins and other members of the committee. I'm Tiki Brown, the commissioner of the new Department of Children, Youth, and Families. The Department of Children, Youth, and Families was created to, was established to create a sustainable public face for children's issues in state government with aligned outcomes and policy, improving the front door for services, easing access and navigation for families, and improving services overall. In June of this year, program integrity, licensing, and other functions from the DHS Office of Inspector General will transfer to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, creating our own OIG, headed by our recently hired Inspector General. Ensuring DCYF applies the highest standards of integrity monitoring and fraud prevention to our programs is a key priority of mine and of the governor's. Increasingly, or accordingly, DCYF has two provisions in the governor's 26-27 biennial budget intended to address fraud and misuse of public funds. The first provision is the DCYF portion of the governor's fraud prevention package is the completion of a multi-year effort to implement electronic enrollment and attendance record keeping for the Child Care Assistance Program, or CCAP, providers. Currently, the state does not require electronic record keeping, which results in inconsistent and variable record keeping practices. This is not conducive to effective program integrity monitoring. 2019 reports from the Office of Legislative Auditor and an internal DHS report recommended that CCAP adopt a statewide electronic record system as a tool to improve program integrity. These reports stated that paper records could be easier to falsify and may lack credibility, and that using electronic records may reduce administrative burden, make it easier to consistently collect data, and enable investigators to identify trends and outliers early and prevent potential fraud and misuse of public funds. It would also give the department the ability to proactively address issues before they escalate and continue to shift the focus of the department's program integrity efforts towards preventing fraud rather than enforcing consequences after fraud had been committed. While the recommendation came in 2019, there was no way to immediately implement an electronic record-keeping approach. So the Child Care Assistance Program and the Office of Inspector General staff put together a plan of action. At the request of the legislature, DHS provided a memo in 2021 with information on implementing an electronic record-keeping system. The memo stated that the first step in moving towards an electronic system required the state to establish a centralized CCAP provider registration and renewal system. Between 2021 and 2023, DHS staff and leadership planned for a statewide provider registration and renewal system and received funding in 2023. That system will be implemented in April, and the agency is now ready to move to the final step in implementing electronic attendance record keeping. For many providers, the process of keeping electronic attendance records won't be new. DCYF has been using electronic attendance and enrollment records for the Great Start Compensation Support Payment Program currently. The governor's proposal requires that the same electronic attendance record-keeping system to be used by all providers receiving CCAP and will incorporate the electronic system into MEC Squared, which is the state's system for payments for child care payments and billing. One of the first steps I took when at DCYF was establishing our chief compliance officer to take an initial look at processes and procedures for compliance across grant programs and other aspects of our work to identify ways of enhancing our work across the agency. The initial high-level scan identified gaps in compliance staffing. Accordingly, the governor's proposal also includes two FTE in the DCYF compliance office to enhance the agency's internal process controls, grant monitoring, and data analytics to improve oversight of public programs. These positions will enhance the agency's capacity to effectively monitor programs and other entities receiving public funding, prevent negative audit findings, and ensure that DCYF meets its statutory obligations to remove bad actors from public programs when program integrity violations occur. One position will serve as our limit on receiving public funds coordinator, and the other FTE will serve as the agency's subrecipient monitoring and data analytics coordinator. The two FTEs will work closely to coordinate their work to develop agency-wide programs and initiatives to ensure that DCYF is both meeting its regulatory obligations and providing broad-based support to programmatic teams in their monitoring efforts. And that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Brown. When I'm looking at this and hearing you speak a lot about the specifically looking at the electronic attendance record keeping system, you know, I'm thinking about the CCAP fraud that we've seen. We've seen the stories about plenty of these, call them companies, call them nonprofits, childcare providers, where they were fraudulently saying that there were more students or kids present there. So I'm curious, what are the mechanisms that are going to be in place with your electronic attendance record keeping system to keep it from not being the providers who are providing those answers on record keeping?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. So with the electronic record keeping system, it will allow for additional data for the state to analyze. So one of the pieces that we're excited about is on-demand anomaly checks. This will, with the new system, it will allow for an automation on attendance records for anomalies, being able to track different trends and be able to flag individuals and entities much more quickly than a in-person walking through some of the paper records that currently exist.
Madam Chair.
Yes,
I'm not sure the commissioner understood my question. My question is it the provider that's going to be doing the electronic checking in, or is it the parents who are going to be checking in the child? Because the fraud that we have seen in this space has been these providers saying that they have dozens or hundreds of kids on site, and we haven't seen, number one, we've seen stories that have just said this is absolutely not what's happening. And so, number one, I want to make sure that we have the mechanisms in place that are doing this. And then in addition to that, I want to also hear what the agency is going to do to ensure, you know, we've talked a lot about site visits. Is the agency going to follow up on the actual what the parents are saying with site visits to ensure that we aren't seeing more fraud in this space?
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. Thanks for clarifying that question. So indeed, what we've looked at with the electronic record keeping is that there are mechanisms for parents to log in themselves and check their child in and check their child out, which does remove the provider falsifying information.
Last follow-up, Representative Schultz.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I heard you say that there are the mechanisms, but is that the way that the program's going to work, yes or no?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Representative. The system is not yet implemented, so as we are, if we receive funding for this and we work through a process with an RFP, those mechanisms will be spelled out much more clearly.
If I could follow up, I'd like to just go along with what Representative Schultz is saying for a minute. So as part of this, do you plan to increase actual site visits?
Thank you, Chair. The electronic record keeping system proposal that we have forward does not include an increase in site visits for child care providers. What it does is allow us access to data to review information that we have on providers in the child care system.
Thank you for that answer. I honestly am very concerned about that. So what we saw in the autism center, that the warrant that was issued in just December of 2024, is parents were checking in children who were then found to be in attendance at their regular public school. So if it's all just data, nobody's checking by site visits, we won't know if in fact the children are in the child care or if they're doing something else. So site visits has to be a component of effective management. And that's been a failing of the current system. And if this is not fixed, all the new record keeping in the world isn't going to solve that. So I highly encourage you to look at that component of it. All right. Let's move on. Commissioner Jett, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, good morning. My name is Willie Jett, and I have the privilege to serve as the Commissioner of Education. Thank you for this opportunity to present the Minnesota Department of Education's components of the Governor's Fraud Prevention and Program Integrity Package.
Commissioner, if I could just ask you to be a little closer to the microphone. Sorry, we've had trouble with that mic in here in the past, so just thank you.
Okie doke. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, can you hear me? Okay, start over. Madam Chair, members, good morning. My name is Willie Jett, and I have the privilege to serve as the Commissioner of Education. Thank you for the opportunity to present the Minnesota Department of Education's components of the Governor's Fraud Prevention and Program Integrity Package. I'll be covering investments and enhancements we are proposing for fraud, waste, and abuse prevention by our Office of Inspector General, as well as the investments in the legal team and improved oversight of the charter school sector. After I began as Education Commissioner at the start of 2023, we partnered with the legislature to fund and set up our OIG team at the Department of Education. In 2024, the legislature passed much-needed clarification and authority around the OIG's mission to combat fraud, waste, and abuse in the department's programs. In 2023, the legislature also passed some critical oversight and program policies for charter schools and in the nutrition space. However, as a continuous improvement organization, we believe that more can be done, which brings me to our fraud prevention and program integrity proposals for this legislative session. First, we're proposing $550,000 annually for three FTEs and software advancements. Second, we are proposing one investigator added to the OIG team, and this position will increase the capacity of the OIG to investigate fraud, waste, and abuse, and more quickly address complaints. And third, we're proposing two legal counsel positions under our Office of General Counsel. This will focus on nutrition and charter schools. One position will provide legal advice and support to ensure MDE is asserting maximum regulatory authority over nutrition program participants. The other legal counsel will ensure the agency is effectively exercising required oversight of charter schools and is addressing program integrity and related challenges. And finally, we propose funding for software advancements to aid the OIG's in-depth investigations by furthering the capacity of the office to track cases and conduct financial analysis of programs. We're also proposing policy for our OIG and charter school program oversight. As the OIG progresses through its second year, we have identified critical areas in last year's legislation to build off of. And this includes expanding the OIG's jurisdiction around the incidents of theft and abuse, enhancing protections for the investigation process, investigative data, and good faith reporters. And this is improving the OIG's access to program participant records and enhancing the sanctions MDE has available when the sanctions may be applied and clarifying rights of appeal. These changes will support a more robust MDE OIG to further prevent fraud, waste, and abuse and enhance program integrity. And our final portion of this package sets forth expectations for charter schools by enhancing fiscal oversight, improving transparency, and justifying need. And this includes clarifications on state procurement law, requiring submission of the annual charter school audits to MDE, requiring the recording and publication of meeting minutes on school websites, and market need and demand studies when schools move or amend grades, sites, and programs. Again, I'd just like to thank you for the opportunity to provide an overview of the Governor's MDE Fraud Prevention and Program Integrity Package. And we strongly believe that these investments and policy proposals will build off of the work already done, especially in 2023 and 2024, and help combat fraud, waste, and abuse, especially fraud, waste, and abuse integrity in MDE's programs. And with that, that concludes my testimony.
Thank you. Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Commissioner Jett. My understanding is most of these positions haven't, within the OIG, or not most, a lot of them aren't filled currently. So it sounds like you're filling them, the existing positions? And I also have a question. Right now, can the OIG refer cases to law enforcement, or is it being done? My understanding is it has to go through the commissioner, that they don't actually have a lot of, they don't have legal authority, they don't have authority to directly on their own independently refer cases to law enforcement.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members. So the first question, I believe you talked about staff and the mm-hmm. number of staff. And so we're almost fully staffed. And one of the things I'd like to say is we've recruited a highly trained staff, and they have decades of experience. Currently, we have 7 staff that are hired right now, and a few more in the final stage of the hiring process. And then the second question you asked in terms of?
Vice Chair Anderson.
Okay. The right now, pre this proposal, does the MDOIG have authority on their own independently to refer cases to law enforcement? My understanding is they don't, that everything they do has to go through the commissioner right now.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members. So, yes, they can, in terms of answering your question. And they do directly, can report directly to law enforcement. They work with law enforcement all the time. And so, yes, they can, to answer your question.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Okay.
No, I'm going to.
Awesome. Representative Elkins.
So, Madam Chair?
Oh, Commissioner, I'm sorry. I thought you had finished.
Madam Chair, members, their sanction authority lies within the commissioner in terms of that's the question.
Okay.
Did you have a follow-up saying
no,
when it relies
on
the...
No, I just answered my question.
Thank you. All right.
Also the commissioner.
Okay.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would disagree with the proposition that you... shouldn't be able to cross-check child care enrollment data with school enrollment data. I have no doubt that that's not possible now, but I think that's something that is to be aspired to as part of the work that is being done in both DCYF and education. In fact, in the education department's student longitudinal education data system, SLEDS, is probably one of the, maybe the best example of effective data sharing among state agencies. When I read the frontline worker pay study, I probably took away, being the information technology geek on the panel, different lesson than many of you may have. But when I read that one, I saw an extraordinary 5-month effort by 4 agencies, Dolly, Deed, Minute, and Department of Revenue, to assemble data from 3 different agencies in order to administer a program. And part to the extent that there were issues in that program, a lot of them were just because there were provisions in state law that made it difficult for them to share the data, which is why I'm carrying the data sharing part of this, the governor's package here. But I don't think that we, not disagreeing that, we should, site visits are going to be important. There's a lot more that we can do more effectively root out fraud and make all of our agencies more efficient. If we can just do a better job of breaking down the silos that prevent our agencies from sharing data in these obvious use cases that we ought to be pursuing.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. So will your data sharing provisions include that opportunity?
Yeah.
Thank you.
At least when it comes to fraud. I think there should be more broad than that. In fact, when the governor was first elected, he created this Blue Ribbon Council on IT reform. It was half private sector, half public sector, and it was so effective in examples like the Minlar's replacement project, which was done in less than a year on time and on budget by buying off-the-shelf software. That we now have within the Technical Advisory Commission, which is how we institutionalize the Blue Council, we now have a data sharing work group that is looking at exactly this issue. and Assistant Commissioner Christensen, who's in the back over there, is a vice chair of that committee. I'm a regular participant. And I think we're going to be successful in identifying a lot of good examples like this. And part of that work is going to be identifying and eliminating the barriers in state law more generally that prevent that kind of effective data sharing.
Thank you. All right, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My questions are for Commissioners Gandhi and Tomes. So if there's a member who has a question for Commissioner Jett, they should probably go before me.
Thank you, Commissioner Jett. We'll invite Commissioner Gandhi and Tome up, please. Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Tomes, in the absence of a statewide grant management system that's shared by all the state agencies, do you have any concern about compatibility of these disparate systems that exist in the different agencies and its ability upon your task of effectively analyzing data?
Commissioner Tomes.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a really great question. I don't know if it would be quantified as concern as much as just inefficiencies and extra complexity, extra layers, as it relates to the number of different grant management systems. The grant management systems that exist in the state, and I would need to follow up to verify this 100%, but I think all of them are vendor-based solutions that they're not home-built solutions, and as such, have had a certain degree of modernization. Probably not incredibly aged from a tech debt perspective. So the ability to interface with these systems, what we refer to as APIs, the ability to get at data from disparate systems, is the likelihood is very high. So confident in being able to do it. Just the complexity of not being able to interface with one system, but maybe being, having to interface with 10 or 12 different systems. And that's where the resources to create robust data warehouses that hold these types of transactions, the data sharing that Representative Elkins references is so important, because there's so much data that we have in so many different places: birth and death certificate records, employment verification capabilities at deed, income verification capabilities at the Department of Revenue, and our ability to holistically bring so many of these department lists, so many of these different data sources together to create this robust capability to analyze data is important. So sorry for the long-winded way of answering your question. Concern, probably no. Just the extra complexity and the inefficiencies of having to integrate so many different things.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for, I appreciate the detail. So what I'm hearing is that the job would be easier if we had a single source, a statewide grant management system.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I certainly would defer to the Department of Administration from a business perspective. What is easy for us, or easiest for us from a technology perspective, is not necessarily always the correct lens to look through. I think the correct lens to look through in most instances and in all instances is, the need to meet business needs. I think at 100,000 foot level, and I think my Commissioner Peer would concur, the fewer systems, in particular when they do the same things, the better. The better for a lot of reasons. More effective for the state, cheaper for the state, easier, lower complexities. But grant making mechanisms across the executive branch, vary widely from two organizations, two individuals. Things like e-bike programs or EV rebates, just a lot of different complexities associated with that. So I don't know if you can get necessarily for all grant making to one system, but the least systems, the better.
Thank you. Representative Hudson, last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have two questions. I'll ask them at the same time for Commissioner Gandhi. You mentioned around 400 referrals that you've made of suspected fraudulent activity. Who did you refer those to, and of them, how many resulted in criminal investigations or convictions? That's question one. The second is, you mentioned that the department has recovered $18 million. Does that represent money that's been clawed back after grants have been administered, or just savings from payments that were stopped?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Hudson. The $18 million represents recovered. Larger than that, it's about $35 million a year that's either avoided or we seek to recover. And then the first question.
Representative Hudson, do you want to restate?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Gandhi. So the first question was, of the 400 referrals that you've made, who were those made to, and did it result in criminal investigations or convictions, or how many of them, roughly?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Hudson, we routinely refer to the BCA, FBI, HHS, OIG. So if you'd like the specifics on where, I can get back to you. I don't happen to have those off the top of my head. And the convictions, I would say, are probably a high number because, you know, once they're vetted enough within DHS to seem to have potential for fraud, then it goes on. And I would have to ask the prosecutors to come up with the numbers of what percent or what the specific numbers are that actually resulted in successful prosecution.
Thank you. I do have a question as well regarding that. So of the 400 referrals, how many did you stop payment on when they were referred?
So,
Commissioner
Chair Robbins, we work collaboratively with our law enforcement agencies. We would stop payments on as many as possible if it is not going to impact the investigation or tip off the people that we are investigating.
Great. Well, if you could provide that number for me of how many were stopped payments, just the high-level number, not individual cases, that would be great. Thank you. Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. And also the numbers that Representative Hudson asked for. So of the 400 referrals, who did they go to and how many were actually prosecuted? That would be very good. So I have a couple of questions. The regulation that's proposed in here, regulating the autism centers, what is done in other states currently? And are they regulated? Are these entities regulated?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Anderson, I would have to research that, or if there are staff that have researched that know, I might ask them.
Looks like they'll get back to you.
Okay, thanks. Vice Can you Chair get back Anderson. To us on that? Because I'm really curious as to what is going on in other states. And then there was a news story recently where you were quoted as saying that an OIG, an independent OIG, is not legal, or there was concern about that, that you had concern, which surprised, shocked me that was the case. But can you explain your position on that?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Vice Chair Anderson. Yes. So the administration is open to working with everybody on good ideas for the IG. The point that I was making in the letter is just that this is a complicated matter with the federal government, and the specifics matter. So we need to make sure to get that correct, working with attorneys and federal relations experts so that we don't run into any unintended consequences. Absolutely support all good ideas for strengthening program integrity in the state of Minnesota, including various configurations of IG.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I have a follow-up question regarding that letter as well. So I was honestly surprised about it, and one of my concerns is that there seems to be a lot of shuffling of the people on the deck chairs. So would people go to the IG's office from DHS, or would it just be an open process where people from anywhere can apply for these positions?
Chair Robbins, I'm not sure that I understand that question.
So my understanding is that in the Senate over this issue, there was quite a lot of concern raised that people from the department would go to the new Inspector General office And that continues to be a point of debate. And so I'm just wondering what the department's position on that is. Would you want staff from DHS to go over to any new IG that's created, or would the IG be solely responsible for the hiring?
Chair Robbins, what I think is most important is that we align state law with what works with our federal obligations. And so I think we need to work with federal relations experts and attorneys that understand the intricacies of that. And they will help us understand what we need to do at DHS to maintain our federal obligations, and then what is possible with an independent, for example, IG. The specifics for me of who moves over are not as important as making sure that we are doing the best that we can in Minnesota to have program integrity and meeting our federal obligations.
Thank you. Yes, I share that. And my understanding is it's done in other states, and that it's very possible to have the federally required OIG requirements met while they're still an independent office. So I hope we can continue to pursue that. Additional questions? Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just actually on this question of separation of powers, because I looked into it on another issue that I was working on, creating the NCFA, which has nothing to do with this. But unlike other states, I don't know how other states' constitution are structured, but we have Article 3, which is about the distribution of government powers. And so I've spent a lot of time with nonpartisan staff, with Matt Gearing, but if you read the powers of the state government divided into three distinct departments, the reason that the OLA has to be advisory is that they're exercising legislative authority, and we can't have a legislative or legislative appointments to an executive function. That has been the long-standing reading of the Constitution. It puts some limitations on what we do. I don't think it prevents us from having an inspector general that operates in a way that we want, but we do have the limitations of the Minnesota Constitution and Article 3. So just to spend a lot of time on that in my life. But beyond that, I'm interested, we haven't talked a lot about the sober home pieces of this as it relates to DHS. And I know New Way and other things have been in the news. I have a few constituents who have come to me, both folks who are peer recovery support, folks who have been, I'd say, taken advantage of by companies, as well as residents, participants of these sober homes, who I think have been put into positions that I would say are exploitive, if not fraudulent. And I'm wondering, as I'm reading this bill, the pieces that we're adding to prevent the double billing, to prevent some of the abuses we've seen in sober homes. Can you expound a little bit more on that? Because I know that's right in the news recently.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Greenman, thank you for that. Yes, DHS would like to strengthen our oversight over these new services that the new Medicaid services that we've expanded. So it is important to have licensure. I mean, there's EIDBI, there's Housing Support Services, SUD, and depending on the service, we want to be sure that we can enroll providers, we have the right oversight over providers, we have either licensing or getting on the path to licensing, provisional licensure. We want to tighten up the billing and make it very clear using the Minnesota Department of Health's rule and CMS standards so that there is not misinterpretation of the billing.
Representative Greenman?
I appreciate that, and I particularly reading this 100-page bill, appreciate that part that gets really explicit about the double billing that we saw, I think, in New Way, and we want to prevent other places. I have just one other question, sort of going to another part of DHS, about some of the things that I keep hearing about in terms of long-term care and more, and I'm looking at the area around 8.11 on page 80. But the pieces around particularly Section 2 in return for purchasing, leasing, ordering, or arranging, or inducing, or participating, or ordering of food, goods, facilities, both the kickback piece, but also I've heard a lot of stories about inflated billing, about long-term care facilities that have relationships with food providers or others, contractors, where the whole price goes up because of value-based billing. And I am not an expert in this area, but I have heard in a few different spaces about it, and I'm wondering what the bill, as I look at these sections, what powers this give us to deal with that, because we know that the costs of long-term care, and particularly the long-term care private facilities, the public or private equity is getting in the game, want to make sure that the billing is staying true to the market value that of the services being provided.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Greenman, I also am not an expert in long-term care billing, but I appreciate that that we have been working closely with our experts, our subject matter experts in that area, as well as our program integrity experts, to make sure that we put strong language in there that helps us both from a monitoring standpoint and from following up on any concerning billing activities.
Last one,
yeah, just a comment, because I think in every place where we see government become a profit center or a mark, it's not always fraud, but often it is. But in other cases, it's a situation where if there is money to be made, I think we need to really make sure that we have the provisions in place to make sure that those contracts are market rate. When I see private equity get into a government provided services, it makes me very nervous, because their whole job is to maximize a profit for their shareholders before getting out. And so I just want to make sure, especially in the industries that we have seen targeted for private profit and private equity, that we are being really, really careful about how we're structuring those contracts and the oversight of those contracts. And so I appreciate the pieces in this bill. I look forward to learning more.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. I have a technical question. The Medicaid expansion, when the dollars are coming through for expanded services from Medicaid, what are the requirements from the feds? Around fraud prevention? Or are they just letting us sort of execute these programs on our own?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Vice Chair Anderson. Thank you for that question. Yes, the requirements are the same. So we, in terms of making sure that we are paying accurately and taking reasonable efforts to detect and prosecute fraud. However, when the legislature has enacted these programs without other controls such as licensure that allow us to move upstream to do more on the enrollment phase, on the visiting ahead of time, training and providing more guardrails for the programs up front, that's the piece that I was speaking about. So the front end.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Another quick question. I'm real curious about that. The like the recovery centers or the autism centers specifically, we're talking about potentially licensing them, and we'll find out what's done in other states. How much of that is reimbursed by Medicaid? What percent of these programs are actually reimbursed?
Commissioner
Gandhi. The state versus state dollars.
Commissioner Gandhi. Mm.
Chair Robbins, Vice Chair Anderson, I don't know the percent off the top of my head. How much is the state share versus the federal share?
Yeah, of the licensing mm-hmm. costs. Okay.
Oh.
Is that something that we're picking up, or is that something that the feds would share or pay for?
Commissioner Gow.
Chair Robbins, Representative Anderson, we do have in our bill state fund dollars for increasing licensing and various activities exactly for this reason, because the state does need to support that. What I don't know is what level of federal share there is for that. But for example, with the EIDBI providers, we and housing stabilization support providers, We are making plans to designate those high risk, and in the governor's package is funding for the increased licensing visits, site visits, those activities that will help us on the front end, and so very much asking for your support in passing those provisions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So I have another question, since we have time. So my concern, just writ large, and maybe this is more for you, Chair Pinto, I'm not sure, is that we're spending a lot of money. We're doing some licensure, which I think is needed. We're doing IT and data analytics, but it doesn't seem like we're doing anything on holding agency staff accountable. So many of these problems have been because people in the agencies, many of whom are very well intended, but they didn't catch this, or when it was caught, no one was held accountable. And I don't see anything in other proposals that I've had with the OLA about, I forget which slide it was, but they want to do more training. They want to do more financial controls. Great. No one is saying you're going to mandate employees to take this training. That's something that the OLA has repeatedly asked for. We haven't said that we're going to change job descriptions. We're not going to say that if someone has violated these policies, they're going to be fired. The other commissioner testified, well, we'll investigate, we'll see what happens. So I'm looking for, where is the accountability for state agencies? So if you could point that out to me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, so I think we want to start with the understanding that, as far as I'm aware, there's been no allegations of wrongdoing by state employees, right? So there's no, I mean, each of these incidents have involved outside actors, organizations behaving wrongly, including individuals involved in those organizations, but no allegation of wrongdoing by state employees.
And to clarify,
please, yeah.
I believe that is correct, but state employees who oversee these programs and have a responsibility to ensure that grants are managed properly have not been held accountable when they failed to do that.
And Madam Chair, I mean, what I'll note, so I've got, I guess that first slide is up. If you think about the buckets of this package, you know, first item, detection and oversight. If you don't have the detection ability, I mean, enhancing detection ability then puts state workers in a better position and state leaders in a better position, a much better position to act, right? Because you first have to detect that it's going on. I guess I just to deal with a couple of specific things that you mentioned. What I recall from prior testimony is that, in fact, state employees involved in grants, in grants management and making decisions about grants, do in fact receive training. It's something that all those employees are receiving. We can get some clarification on that if, you know, our recollections are different. We've got a bunch of commissioners here, but my understanding is that that is in place. To the questions that went to Commissioner about state employees being required to report if there's a grant, some sort of violation, we don't know, and I guess I say this as prosecutor, right? Facts of situations vary widely. If all we have, let me see if I can find that exact slide. All we have is that, yeah, a state employee fails to report a violation of a grant rule. We could just say it that way. I don't know that immediately we know that that person who failed to report that should be, you know, criminally prosecuted or fired, right? Maybe they didn't report it because, in fact, they somehow, you know, they didn't have the opportunity to or something. Like, all we know is that exact, is just those words. So I guess what I heard the commissioner say is, as with any employee situation, we look into what the employee is doing. If the employee does something that they're not supposed to do, we're going to look into that. But I think we all know in any enterprise that we work in, you don't automatically say, well, immediately somebody gets fired when a particular thing happens. We have to look at those situations. So what I would say is, if we start with the understanding no wrongdoing by state employees, we may say there need to be greater tools. I understand maybe you're concerned about there being particular accountability. I think that's where we have to kind of get to specifics, to my mind, and say, in this particular situation, what happened in this situation? That's where we've got the OLA providing reports back to us. And that's where I think we need to look at it. But ultimately, we are a state that is providing a lot of support to make sure that Minnesotans can thrive in their lives. And there are people who are taking advantage of that. And we absolutely need to work all of us together to make sure that anybody who's trying to take nefarious advantage of that is being caught, being held accountable. And in the three buckets that that were up there before, I think this is a package that does that.
Thank you. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Commissioner Gandhi, you had talked about 4,000 investigations and 400 referred to law enforcement. Over what period of time? Is that per year, or is that over since 2020? Because I know when we've had you here before, you said that in CCAP you've recovered $2.4 million since 2020. So I'm just curious as to what period of time.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick, since 2020.
Any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that's a huge difference between, because your last number, your 18 million, was the average annual recovery. So now we're conflating 4,000 investigations, which really are only about 1,000 per year, and you have nearly 500 in the IG's office. That means, I'm assuming then, the 400 referred to law enforcement is 400 since 2020. Is that correct?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Correct.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Madam Chair, when someone comes, Madam Chair, to give us statistics and facts, as was stated, and you say, I have 4,000 investigations, I have 400 referred to law enforcement, we've got 18 million per year recovered, those numbers are conflated. They are not the same time frame whatsoever. It should be 1,000 per year average, 100 referred to law enforcement on average, when they have nearly 500 people in this investigative unit for DHS, and they plod back $18 million per year out of $25 billion budget. $25 billion. So this makes no sense to me whatsoever. And I think I heard the commissioner also say that she has an increase in FTEs for site visits. I'd like to know how many FTEs, and are they going to plan to go all the way up to Thief River Falls and International Falls and Bemidji? I mean, are they going to do site visits all over the state or virtually?
Commissioner Gandhi, could you address the site visits?
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick. Yes, our employees that do site visits go all over the state of Minnesota now. And with the increase in the number of providers and services, we need to increase that number because they are on the road all the time.
Representative Rarick.
And what would that number be in this proposal?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick. In this proposal, we have staff for, I have it by area, so I'll give you the numbers as I have them now. If you would like them in a different format, we can go back and get it for you. But we have one staff for substance use disorder treatment services changes. We have 8 for improving supportive recovery housing options. We have 59 staff for detecting, preventing, addressing fraud in human services. We have 36 devoted to EIDBI, provisional licensure and program integrity. We have 45 for program integrity investigative analytics infrastructure. And we have 2 for background studies disqualifications.
Commissioner, Representative Rarick.
Thank you. So are all of these, it's, you know, over 100, they're all going to be doing site visits and verifying the electronic data? Because I know that there's a move, everything that you've talked about, not you personally, but this whole presentation is about, well, we're going to fix everything through AI, we're going to, even though our underlying programs are terrible, they were built in, you know, they're ancient, and they were built in the 80s and the 90s, and they're green screens, F keys, and the wheel of death, so we're going to put AI on top of these horrible programs. So how many of these people are actually going to go out physically do site visits to see that there actually are children and unannounced, I should say, unannounced site visits to make sure there are actually children in those programs being served, that there's actually kids in the autism centers being served, that there's actually people being served in the EIDBI programs. Like, are these additional, I haven't added it up, but it's more than 100, going to be actually doing site visits specifically?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick, the numbers that I have are holistic to support program integrity within DHS. I would need to go back to staff to find out which specific ones will be added to licensing and audits that would go out and do the visits.
Thank you. I have a question following that. So you said 59 for fraud and 45 for program integrity. Are those in addition to the, I believe in an earlier hearing you said there were 491 people in the OIG office currently. So those are new staff in addition to the 491 in the DHS OIG office?
Chair Robbins, yes, that is correct. Our OIG office includes licensing, background studies, program integrity, data analytics. So there's a number of areas, and our budget, as has been discussed, has been increasing, and the programs that we oversee are increasing. So at DHS, in terms of operations, we have about 1.7% of our budget, let me get the number exactly right here. Right now in 2022, our operations and IT, which includes all sorts of internal controls, including finance, et cetera, was about 2.7% of the DHS budget. By 2027, that will be going down to 1.9% of our budget. So very slim operational oversight for a large program. And so, yes, we are asking for increased FTEs.
Thank you. So we have three questions left. We'll try and go lightning fast. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think if there's one theme today, and Representative Rarick keeps bringing it up, but we're the agencies, especially DHS and DCYF, are operating under ancient systems built in the 1980s, and they need to be replaced. Last time I asked Chair Neuer what was the current estimate for how much that would cost, he said, well, somewhere in the range of $800 million to $1 billion. Almost everything that we're talking about today is going to require investment in improving the capabilities of the people in these agencies to be able to do their jobs and ferret out fraud. And I'm concerned that we're spinning up a narrative here that if all of these people were just a little bit more conscientious, we could immediately root out hundreds of millions of dollars in fraud that we could apply towards balancing the next budget, when the opposite is true. If we really want to be serious about rooting out fraud, we're going to have to make some significant investments here in giving these people better analytical tools to do their jobs. Thanks.
Representative Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you, and I'll be quick. Revenue wasn't here, but I do want to point out the two revenue proposals I think are really good. So
and
in the bill.
Ms. Bears is here for the record, so I don't know if you had a question for her.
Nope, I don't. I think it's good that we're sharing data with individuals, and I think it's good that we're taking away the prepay on the child tax credit. So those are really good things. I agree that this is a data problem. Every individual that's receiving services should have some sort of unique identifier. Yep. Are they at school? Are they at daycare? Are they getting services for this? And are there four different autism centers billing for the same thing? Yep. Okay, that's, you know, we should have these basic things. I don't think it's going to cost $1 billion to do it. But I think that needs to get done. It would be done in any private business, and it obviously doesn't exist here. But I think we also have to deal with the culture. When there are problems, and we knew there were problems, I mean, the things that we've seen publicly are the biggest things that, you know, they're huge. And we knew about it as it was going on, and we didn't do anything. Okay, so there's got to be a ton of stuff that we haven't heard about that's going on. And that's just, it's got to stop. People are losing and have lost faith in the state government to manage programs. And we see that all up and down government. That's part of what's happening at the federal level, and we have that going on here. So we have to fix these things. I do think there are some good things in here that I could support. There are other things I don't think, you know, that doesn't change the culture. We have to change the culture. When we find fraud, we have to act on it immediately. And we need to find it through IT or through whatever. But stipends, we've got to act right away. So I know we have very limited time. I'll turn over to the chair. Thank you.
Thank you. We are out of time, but Chair Pinto, I'd like to give you just a closing comment on your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And I'll just note there's a 2024 report by the credit monitoring company Experian that says that two-thirds of large U.S. companies are increasing their investments to fight fraud, and that's our state can be no different. This is a really good package. You see the three components of it, and I just want to emphasize to all of us again, this has been a multi-year effort. We can be really proud of the work we've done in past years, and I want to make sure we're proud of the work that we do this session as well to deal with fraud, not just in our public programs, but all different ways that Minnesotans are being defrauded, so we want to make sure to be fighting that. I appreciate the time this morning, Madam Chair, for your work. Thanks all.
Thank you, and thank you to all of the commissioners and testifiers who came. We greatly appreciate your time coming before the committee. Have a great day. Thank you. We are adjourned.